This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Independent counsel Kenneth Starr's initial assignment was to investigate the Whitewater real estate deal in Arkansas. Now it's led him to an inquiry into allegations about the president's sex life and his possible involvement in an obstruction of justice. The path of Kenneth Starr's investigation raises the question of what the job of the independent counsel is and what limits the law imposes on the counsel's authority. My guests are The Wall Street Journal's national political correspondent John Harwood and the paper's Supreme Court correspondent Edward Felsenthal. Their story in today's Wall Street Journal focuses on the unfolding of Kenneth Starr's inquiry and on the history of the office, originally known as the Special Prosecutor. The name was changed to Independent Counsel in an effort to avoid the appearance that the people targeted were criminals. I asked John Harwood to remind us why the Office of Special Prosecutor was first created in the wake of Watergate 20 years ago.
Well, after the Watergate scandal had occurred, and during that time, you'll recall, there was a special counsel appointed by the Justice Department whom Richard Nixon fired when the going got very rough in the investigation. Democrats in Congress, in particular, pushed the idea that there needed to be a mechanism created to investigate top executive branch officials that would be more insulated from politics. And the independent counsel law, it had a different name then, was enacted as part of a broad-ranging Ethics in Government Act, and it was designed to remedy that problem.
Let's talk about how the law actually works. The attorney general decides whether there's cause for the appointment of an independent counsel. But as we've seen in the last few months, in which Janet Reno has declined to appoint a special prosecutor to look into the president's and the vice president's fundraising practices, there's a huge gray area in which the attorney general can move. Is the law so unclear about the appointment of an independent counsel that there's room for such an array of interpretation?
Well, the gray area is not that huge, but the Attorney General's discretion is huge. In other words, once the Attorney General makes a decision, it can't be reviewed by anybody, can't be reviewed by a court, can't be reviewed by the President or Congress. So it is the Attorney General's call, but the language in the statute is pretty specific, and that's, of course, what generated so much controversy over her decision not to appoint an independent counsel. The threshold is pretty low. Anytime that she's got specific and credible evidence that something's gone wrong, she has to investigate it. And if at the end of her investigation, her initial investigation, it looks like she needs to know more, she really is obligated by law to turn it over to an independent counsel. So people can debate how specific, how credible some information is. People can debate how big the need is for further investigation. But the threshold is pretty low, and there's actually not that much gray area.
And I'd add, Barbara, that before the campaign finance issue arose, Janet Reno had the reputation, to the chagrin of others in the White House and the administration, of appointing independent counsels at the drop of a hat in cases involving, say, Mike Espy, the Agriculture Secretary, or Henry Cisneros, then the HUD Secretary. And so this was an exception to that pattern.
The Attorney General decides at his or her discretion whether to appoint an independent counsel, but who actually appoints the person?
Janet Reno, in this case, or the Attorney General, asks a panel of three appeals court judges from Washington to appoint an independent counsel, and they basically pick somebody.
Is the authority of the Office of Independent Counsel outlined in the actual law, or is the authority at the discretion of the appeals court that appoints him or her?
The law doesn't say much about what the independent counsel is supposed to do once he takes over. It gives the independent counsel the authority to have conduct grand jury proceedings, to subpoena witnesses, to challenge claims of executive privilege and so forth, but it doesn't really lay out what the prosecutor, what the counsel is supposed to do. It says you're supposed to follow the ordinary Justice Department rules for prosecution. And for prosecutors, but that course has turned into one of the great debates. Critics of this process claim that the independent counsel don't have to act like ordinary Justice Department prosecutors because they've got unlimited budgets and only one case, and they don't make the same kinds of decisions that ordinary prosecutors do. But that's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to, under the law, follow the guidelines for Justice Department prosecutors.
this issue of the unlimited budget of the independent counsel's office is a sore subject, a huge one, I think you could say, with the American public, not only in this investigation, but in others. I'm thinking of Iran-Contra. Is there really no limit in the law to what can be spent?
Well, they've tried to tighten this over the years, and I think, Edward, correct me if I'm wrong, that they have tried to set some guidelines in the statute that place some commonsensical bounds on what the independent counsel spends, but I don't think there's no statutory cap or ceiling on what he can spend. And I think that you mentioned it's a sore spot with the American people, not sore enough for the people who have been the targets of these investigations, because if it's a Republican president, as it was with Ronald Reagan and George Bush during the Iran-Contra investigation, the partisan defenders of those presidents always raised the amount of money spent on the case as a way of trying to bring pressure to end the investigation. Democrats are now talking about how much money Ken Starr has spent, but that really hasn't had a great effect on the course of the investigations, and is more sort of rhetoric thrown out there that doesn't seem to have a lot of impact.
The controls that were put in that when the law was reauthorized 3-4 years ago are pretty wimpy. Basically, you've got to submit more reports. You've got to have more auditing done of your expenses. You now have to work out of a government office as opposed to a private office. Lawrence Walsh had some space in the Watergate that cost millions of dollars in rent. So there are a few provisions, but as John says, the if you've got more to do, the Justice Department really doesn't have much choice other than to approve continuing costs and continuing expenditures. And I might add that not only are we as taxpayers covering the cost of these investigations, but when they prove to turn up nothing, the law provides that we give the targets of the investigations back some of their legal expenses. So we've paid out millions of dollars in legal fees to people who have been unsuccessfully pursued by special counsel.
One thing we can be sure of, we will never reach the point where Ken Starr says, hey, I'm out of money, got to stop there, here's my report. He'll keep going until he's done.
What's the tally now? What are the costs of this investigation?
Ken Starr, according to the General Accounting Office, as of last March, had spent about $26 million. That's not including the $6 million that was spent by his predecessor on the Madison Guarantee investigation, Robert Fisk. So I guess we're at $32
million. How would the independent counsel's investigation be ended? Who has the authority to say, let's end this now, this is over?
Ken Starr. At some point, when he decides that he's done, he will issue a report. That report will go to the Congress. He also has the option of, as he has done in some cases already, filing criminal cases against targets of his inquiry. But ultimately, it's to the independent counsel to put a stop to the thing.
One focus of the debate about the case at hand is whether the current investigation into the president constitutes an expansion of Kenneth Starr's jurisdiction. Now, the broader question, of course, is how did this jurisdiction expand from Whitewater to the White House travel office firings to the White House alleged mishandlings of FBI files to the Paula Jones civil suit to today? Did all of those expansions follow legal pathways? Do they constitute expansions?
There's probably a political answer and a legal answer to that. The legal answer, and I'll leave the political one to John, is that the initial grant of authority to Ken Starr by the appeals court panel that appointed him was extremely broad, and that he has along the way also gotten a very important court ruling from the Federal Appeals Court in St. Louis that basically says, under the law, anything you're doing is pretty much related to anything else. There's no real standard, and if you think you've got something that follows along an earlier lead that seems to similar to a pattern of behavior you've been investigating, you can go for it.
The Starr has gotten from the court at least four publicly disclosed expansion of his authority. some of which, I should say, have occurred at the request of the Justice Department, which I think wasn't anxious to have other independent counsels appointed for these. You had the travel office fiasco, where the incoming White House fired the old employees of the White House travel office and accused them of various things, which turned out not to be true. That was thrown in. So was the Filegate, so-called Filegate issue, where it was discovered that some officials in the White House had possession of old FBI files of people who had worked for previous administrations. There are also some expansions of Starr's authority, which we do not know the nature of because they remain under the seal of the court. So it's both things that have flowed out of other scandals at the White House, and I think generally the expansions have been justified under the broad rubric of obstruction of justice, which is something that Starr has been probing from the beginning, as well as some other things that we can't really explain right now because we don't know.
You've also got a logistical problem here. Okay, so this situation with Monica Lewinsky comes up really late in the game. What are you going to do? Appoint a new independent prosecutor, a new independent counsel who's got to hire new people and set up a new office? I mean, it may not look like what Ken Starr was originally supposed to do, but practically speaking, he's the only guy who can pursue it.
You write that Kenneth Starr probably does have partisan leanings. He might not perhaps like the Clintons personally, but he's still making decisions based on what the law allows or compels him to do, and you make that distinction. John Harwood, your venue is politics. What exactly is his political record? How partisan is Kenneth Starr, really?
He's a very conservative Republican who had been active for years in conservative legal causes and political causes. He served in both the Reagan and Bush administrations. He was Solicitor General under Bush. He served in the Reagan Justice Department. He talked at one time of running for the United States Senate as a Republican in Virginia. He was an advisor to the Competitiveness Council that Vice President Quayle ran during the Bush administration, and he also, we have learned, had some interaction with the attorneys for Paula Jones before he was appointed independent counsel, which is one of the things that Democrats have seized upon in suggesting that essentially he is working hand in hand with the Jones attorneys right now as they pursue their civil lawsuit. Now, I don't think there's a lot of evidence that's taking place, but certainly that's become some smoke the Democrats are pointing to.
My guests are Wall Street Journal reporters Edward Felsenthal and John Harwood. We're talking about the history of the independent counsel law and what the powers and the limits of that office are. Edward Felsenthal is a Supreme Court correspondent. John Harwood is a national political correspondent, and their story on the independent counsel law appears in today's Wall Street Journal. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Wall Street Journal reporters Edward Felsenthal and John Harwood. We're talking about the history and the authority of the Office of Independent Counsel. I thought it was interesting that you quoted a former Watergate prosecutor, Mr. Heyman, who raises the question of whether the Office of Independent Counsel has become more about getting to the truth, with a capital T, about a scandal in the executive branch, as opposed to investigating an actual crime that can be prosecuted in a court of law. It's really a vital distinction.
It is a vital distinction, and I think it gets at a lot of what people think has gone wrong here, that prosecutors aren't making the kinds of judgments, that independent counsels aren't making the kinds of judgments that ordinary prosecutors would, in part because they feel charged with telling our scandal-obsessed culture what really happened in the West Wing of the White House or anywhere else. And it's propelling a lot of these investigations and the expenses and the length of time that we've been talking about that goes into these investigations.
I think of an analogy in our business to what the sort of situation independent counsels find themselves in. Reporters are also paid to investigate things and look into them and find scandal if you can and put it in the newspaper. If you told a reporter, a top investigative reporter, all I want you to do is investigate the mayor of X town, and spend all your time doing that and see what you can come up with. It becomes difficult for that reporter to, after some limited period of time, to say, if this is what he finds, I've looked at this mayor, and I don't really have anything, so we're not going to write a story. The impulse for that reporter is to keep looking and keep looking and keep looking until he can find something that would make a good story. On the other hand, if you're a reporter and you've got 10 things to cover, and this mayor is one of them, and you find after some initial investment of resources that there's not anything particularly interesting or embarrassing to write about, you drop it and go on to something else. And that's the independent counsels are in the former position.
Well, one frustration that the public has is whether this can ever come to court. What is the special prosecutor's, I should say, what is the independent counsel's path to an indictment of a sitting president, and does it lead through impeachment? It seems like a chicken and an egg question.
Well, I think there's big disagreement still among legal scholars as to whether a prosecutor can indict a sitting president. Arguments have been made on both sides, but some people believe that a president would need to first be impeached before he could be tried on criminal charges. This was what I think that attitude governed the special counsel in the Watergate administration, and it was anticipated that if Richard Nixon was going to be tried, he would be tried after he left office. Then, of course, President Ford, who succeeded him, issued a pardon, and that became beside the point. But I don't think we have an answer to that question.
This law comes up for reissue every, 5 years?
Mm-hmm.
Has there ever been any change in it?
Yes. The law has been adjusted. Actually, in each time it's been reauthorized in an effort to cure defects that legislators thought arose in practice. And principally, those have been to try to tighten spending guidelines and those who could be targeted by independent counsels. When it comes up in 1999, some Democrats are now saying that it needs to be tightened further because, in particular, in the last couple of years during a Democratic administration, they are more acutely sensitive to the looseness of the law and the low trigger for establishing independent counsels. But we'll see whether the thing does get reauthorized. You know, Republicans have substantially been opposed to this over the past, and it's possible, of course, that since you still will have a Democrat in the White House, maybe the both parties could come together on this, although it would be politically hard to junk.
The great political trick in this law is that it has to be reauthorized and not repealed. So if you oppose the law, you don't have to stand up and say, I oppose this provision in the Ethics in Government Act, which looks awfully unpopular. All you have to do is sort of keep your mouth shut, and it'll lapse. And if both parties make a tacit agreement to do that, then, you know, we got to start over from scratch, or some of this stuff goes back to the Justice Department. There actually were 2 years at the beginning of the Clinton administration where this law had lapsed, because nobody was pushing it hard enough or fast enough.
During the 1992 campaign, when the Iran Contra special counsel was still grating on Republicans and George Bush, you remember he reissued an indictment and some information about former Defense Secretary Weinberger just before the election. Republicans on Capitol Hill blocked the reauthorization of the law, said they'd filibuster the law, and that's why it lapsed. Then had the Clinton administration and Democrats on the Hill not made it a priority in 1993 and 1994, it probably wouldn't have been reauthorized.
Do you really, in your opinion, think that the law works as it stands now?
Well, I would say that the law that there have been results under the law that a lot of people think are not reasonable. There is still an active independent counsel investigating President Reagan's HUD secretary, Sam Pierce. And I was talking to Carl Levin, the lead Democratic supporter of the law, and he said, yeah, there's still an independent counsel from the Reagan administration. I can't remember his name right now. I don't think anybody envisioned that these sort of things would take that long. But I think ultimately we're talking about political problems and a political culture that has elevated scandal to a very high priority for members of both parties. Personal dirt and scandal have become a weapon of political dialogue, debate, conflict. And I don't think that's a function or a result of the law per se, but the law has probably exacerbated the problem.
John, I don't know if you talked to anybody who felt differently, but I didn't talk to a single person in the course of my reporting who thought this law was working. I talked to people who think we're stuck with it, who think it's part of the permanent political culture. I talked to some people who have some hopes that it can be fixed, but I didn't talk to a single person who was singing its praises. Did you?
I didn't.
Yeah.
I want to thank both of you very much for taking time to talk today on Fresh Air.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
John Harwood is a national political correspondent and Edward Felsenthal, a Supreme Court correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Their article on the independent counsel law appears in today's issue. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.